Yeah, Michael. When I read your book, and
thank you for reading my book, by the way.
Yeah, it was surprising. I thought, wow, a book on communism, a book on Jonas, a communist leader of the Philippines. I didn't know that this exists anymore, because in Europe, as you've probably seen in Holland and Belgium, and it has almost ceased to exist. Whatever you would call it, parties are getting less than 1%. Yeah. And when coming here and talking to people and always mentioning this Jomas thing, everybody says, "Oh, really? Yeah, that's interesting." And it's still an important movement, but it's dangerous. And
fair.
Yeah, and you working on this book, and I mean, would you consider the work on it as dangerous work? I mean, was it dangerous to have it published here? And
yeah, no, I mean, I think journalism in the Philippines is quite dangerous in general. And the way, I think another actually German journalist, the radio, she asked me about this similar question, and I'll answer it in a similar way, if that's all right. But I think that maybe journalistic work in the West and in America, and other, it tends to be about right and wrong. And here it's more about life and death. So that's a simple way. But for this book in particular, I actually haven't been in any kind of direct like danger or threats in any way. I mean, indirectly, I don't know. But I will say, and I don't want to get into too much detail about this, but there has been some pushback internally about getting this book published. With some back and forth and negotiations, we were able to publish this book.
And how was it received here?
I think I wrote it, my editor, we were talking in the beginning about how should we approach this subject, and I think we always identify like who would we specifically write this for? Who would we want this reader to be? And I always thought I wanted it to be a young activist interested in these things, because I mean, to be fair, this is not really the sexiest topic in the world.
I agree.
It's not really the sexiest topic in the world. It's like, what? Like, old people in exile in the Netherlands? Like, it's not. But it is to, I guess, certain sections of the Filipino public, people who are interested in, like, the history and development of progressive politics and the dictatorship period and all of these things. There is a section of that even amongst young people, and I think we wanted to speak to them. And to them, I think the reception among them, I think, has been pretty good. I mean, just today, actually, because actually I've been getting it's sort of like a physical therapy for my hand.
Yeah,
I have carpal tunnel syndrome.
I know that. Yeah, I've read a little bit as well. Yeah,
yeah, it's a pain.
Yeah,
it's pretty bad. So I think the excessive typing,
yeah,
it's not very good. Anyway, so there is this sort of like one of the doctors recommended I try just to relieve the pain. I try out paraffin wax. I've never heard of this, and I tried it out recently. Basically, you dip your hand in hot wax, and it's supposed to have heat.
Right.
It's like a hot compress, but in wax form, and you leave it on your hand for half an hour, and it does bring down the swelling and the pain, and it's quite comfortable. Anyway, I mentioned this because at the clinic, the reception lady at the clinic, she's a young student, and she said, "Are you Michael Beltran, the one who wrote the book about Joma?" I said, "Yes, I am." And I was quite surprised, like, why? This is not really something that I would expect a lot of young people to mention. But I was quite happy and that she had read my book, and that she and her friend were interested in these things in college, and so they looked upon it. And so, but yeah, so I mean, I guess it has had some impact. I cannot measure how, and I wouldn't say my book is among the most popular pieces of literature in the Philippines. I'm nowhere near the, I have Caroline Howe is much more,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
a big deal here. I wouldn't call me or my book any kind of a big deal. But I mean, I'm happy if somebody reads it. And like I said, it's for like a very specific kind of people who are interested in it. So
yeah, I was surprised when reading it that I had so many flashbacks on. I mean, when I was very young, I was into communism as well. I mean, I was really, because my grandfather was living in East Germany, so I visited regularly. And experienced, of course, the other way, the German way of socialistic government, and all that. And I read a lot of books. And of course, I read books by, maybe, I'm not sure if you ever read it, Manus Sperber and his Like a Tear in the Ocean.
Oh, no.
Manus Sperber is a very famous psychologist, and he was part of the German Communist Party in the early 20s. And he traveled to Russia to meet the Comintern, the international communist movement. And he was so disappointed by it that of all the fights against each other and of losing the original idea, that he quit it completely and wrote a very famous novel on his quitting of, and because he visited all this international communists in Croatia and then Yugoslavia and all that, and he really, it is such a sad and beautiful book on losing your face and how party work can destroy the original idea that there are always I always have to, and this was a long time ago. He published it at the end of the 1940s, and then it became a kind of a bestseller for many years. And what I did to read in your book really brought back a lot of these memories of this book. And because when I read Jonah's history, it is of course, this trying to live up the dream, a face somehow changed society, and then all this internal fighting against the new parties coming up and all that. And I wonder how after, I mean, 100 years ago, the Comintern split it into many parties, I mean, and that this topic is still relevant in the Philippines. I mean, why do you think this topic is there at all? I mean, still.
I think, well first of all, I never thought of it like as a book about, it's a book about communists, but it's not a book about communism, I would say. But it does have a lot of that, but I never really, I never approached it that way, just to talk about what is communism and why is it.
Yeah.
But I was always just interested in the people. Mm-hmm. And the people have these certain situations my own background and my own, of course, colored the text and things like that. No? But this, I think it's relevant because it's still happening.
So it didn't stop with Joma's death. I mean, it is still...
Still happening.
I mean, this is like this as your book ended. I mean, in the way, is this the end or is something new coming?
There's something new coming, and especially... It sort of started with Joma and all of the older batch of exiles, I would say. The older arrivals of exiles. But it's something that has been going on for periods. I mean, I mentioned in the book, a slightly younger batch of exiles who came, I think, in the early 2000s. And then there's more and more during the drug war of Rodrigo Duterte, a little bit more. And again, with this continued counterinsurgency operation, a little bit more. And so that's one. And then that two is, like I mentioned, the counterinsurgency operation is still well and alive. I'm not sure, but I think even if there wasn't a communist movement in the Philippines, there would still be some anti-communist activities by the government. It's so well ingrained and painted into our codified into our political policy.
You mean since the 90s with Marcos hunting communists and all that?
So that didn't really go away. It's sort of become institutionalized in every other president. So there is a
communist. You mean institutionalized in a way that the government needs it? I mean, they show, I mean, you're hunting the danger in our society, so you have to elect us to make sure you're protected from these evil.
Yes. That and also that every regime sort of comes up with its own flavor of how to deal with a problem, quote unquote problem, and so that's a lot of what happened during the Marcos period. It's like become institutionalized and ingrained, and so that is still happening today, and that breeds strife, conflict, and that also happens to. result in a lot of people going into exile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
for example, the drug war. I mentioned the drug war. The drug war is just the counterinsurgency method disguised into this anti-narcotics program. But it's the same method that has been used for...
It's just another placeholder, yes. More or less. Yeah. Yeah, I understand. Okay. And when I talk to other people and I ask them, what would Europe be your political vision beside this ever-going family dynasties of politicians coming to power? I mean, and they say, yeah, maybe this kind of leftist movement would be a real alternative, but it is always split. I mean, it is never united in a way. I mean, which
left movement is united?
Of course.
I don't think we can go to the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks. I don't think there's ever. I think that's like in the same way that even the oppressors are never united.
It's true, and they even fight for power.
But they still manage to do their job.
Yeah.
They still manage to do a lot of the oppressing around.
Yeah, I mean, the only difference is that, as far as I've heard, there's still guerrilla fighting in some parts of. And who's financing it? I mean, who's behind it?
Well, it's a lot of different things, but a lot of it is, to be fair, a lot of it is voluntary, and it always has been voluntary. My mother was a guerrilla fighter.
Really?
Yeah. During the Marcos period, and
this was really dangerous. I mean,
it was. Yeah. She didn't come home with a paycheck.
Of course not.
But yeah. So that's what you do. It's still happening. I think also because. And I don't mean to be like, some kind of cliche, but the conditions are generally so severe in a lot of places that it isn't sort of miraculous or it isn't sort of incredulous to think that some people would really just take arms and do something about it rather than just accepting things the way they are.
I mean, accepting things how they are is a country divided by language, by wealth, and...
One of the most divided by wealth. We are not the poorest in Southeast Asia, but I would think if we aren't at the top, we might as well be among the most... the biggest inequality, gap in inequality. Some of the richest people in the Philippines, in the world, in the Philippines. And you meet people who, even in Manila or especially outside Manila, who would never even have a cup of rice to eat for one day, mm-hmm. things like that. And it's still, and I think also in the Philippines, we have, besides this whole inequality gap, which is obviously a big issue, but there is this sort of, and I feel this is like getting older and growing into more into adulthood, that there are these so many little injustices with the transportation, with your basic needs, just me getting my x-ray for my hand. I had to line up for 8 hours.
It's too long.
It's pretty long, yeah. And one day without work. 8 hours is one day without work, and that means one less paycheck that I can make with food and everything and rent and all of these things. So it's a lot of the and this is in the best hospital for bones and things like that. It's an orthopedic hospital, but all of these things, they add up, they accumulate in something and into a lingering and sort of unshakable sense that something is terribly wrong.
And what makes a person then stand up or becoming taking arms?
A movement does. Yeah. And the Philippines and Philippine history is filled with and is coated with movements and so many movements since like the last
it's
three.
It's true, starting from the fight against the Spanish, I mean.
Yeah, which was a 300-year fight.
So exactly, yeah.
So yeah, movements is like, it's a big thing. Yeah.
And what I found very interesting in your book is beside your drawing a picture about Anjoma and his wife, which I really like that you have this sideline as well, painting a picture of her as well. I think she's more or less as important as himself, I think. And this is what's her name again? I forgot.
Julie.
Julia. Yeah. And this is really great the way you put them together. And and what I like as well is how you paint the picture of the not only the exile but all the migrant workers there. I mean, and I wonder. I mean, what in which way are they related to the movement? I mean, they pass by and they go again. I mean, but are they politically really interested in the thing, or is it just that they know Joma is a famous man? Or
well, so actually, in my journalistic work, I actually have focused a lot about migrant workers. Mm. And so, for example, I did some reporting about migrant workers in Belgium as well at another time. But well, with this book specifically, this is something that surprised me, because I would have thought that migrant workers and the exiles, they would not have mixed.
Exactly. This was my
working impression at the start. Yeah. Especially because these exiles in the mainstream viewpoint of a lot of Filipinos, they are like evil and, you know, ruining the country and things. To be fair, like Joma could be, depending on where you stand, he could be the best or he could be the worst, you know, depending on. So I would think that most migrants would, you know, carry the same sort of attitude, but it wasn't true. So, and also I think I learned is also that, because going to the Netherlands, that was my first time in Europe, and I had previously been covering migrants in Asia or had met migrants from the US, and it's very different. Migrants in Asia, Middle East, and also other parts of Asia, they are always, all of them are saving up to come home with a better savings, you know.
It's right. I just read Caroline Howe's book. I mean, the novel she published. It was just published in German, so I read it as well. And it's exactly about that. I mean, it's just saving all the time, and even the mother sending the daughter away to come back. And
that's in Asia, but in Europe it's different. I think this is where, having been there several times and having reported on migrant worker, the goal in Europe is not necessarily to have a savings. The goal in Europe is to stay as long as you can. Is to never go home. And it's a weird kind of dichotomy that the exiles want to go home, the migrants never want to stay, but the exiles can't go home. But in that weird sort of contradiction, they have found themselves in one common thing, which is that they all have this strained relationship with the Philippines. And I think that's what sort of brings them to all.
So this is intersection, more or less. These they all know they won't come back.
Yes.
Yeah. And this is enough to
bring them together. Yeah. So they have parties and they have, like I think I mentioned, like this, they go to KFC and they bring their own rice.
Yeah.
things like that. That is like very. So I think that surprised me. When I was working with them, and so inevitably they're all exiles in a way. Yeah. Some of them are economic exiles, and some of them are from the political situation, and so they meld together in this community.
And did you find it when the lower emotions of them, is there a sadness of knowing them?
Yes, I think I was there. I don't know. I cannot speak for other nations, and this might be some sort of another cliche, but there is a sad. I mean, these places can be so terrible. This whole place can be so terrible. But we always miss it, and this might also be coming from my middle class privilege. But we always have this soft spot for, because it can be so warm also at the same time. There is none of that warmth. I'm sorry to say, there's none of that. There's a different kind of warmth here compared to Europe.
Yeah. And there's always family, isn't it? I mean, that is
family and community. And we have like something that somebody pointed out to me also is that in Europe, in so Filipinos have so many words for the word community, and European and Western language don't have many words for it. And so that is interesting also. So it's like an expression of how historically developed sort of coming togetherness.
Yes, it's interesting. Somebody showed me some old photos on some remote Filipino island that when people in the villages, sometimes they move their houses
together.
Together. Yeah. So we just have a new spot, and the whole community took care of carrying the house to another spot. I mean, and even for this movement.
And if you didn't help, you would be the bad person.
That's right. But even for this special occasion, there was a special word for this movement, this communal move, or whatever you would call it. I mean, I've never heard of that before, and that you just move your house like that and the whole community is taking care of it.
And I think that in a way that is also for the movements, as we talk about movements, that is one of the best tools that Filipinos have to develop movements is our own roots. And maybe that's also why we had a lot of feisty encounters with the Spanish.
Yeah. And for the future, what is your, I mean, do you have any vision, the current situation is a bit frustrating, I would say.
Yeah.
And, but.
Always is, have been.
Is it almost? Yeah. Before.
It's like, I don't know, it's always getting worse, it's never getting better.
Okay, so let's close with this. Yeah, that's a nice ending.
Yeah. Unless maybe something big happens, you know?
What would be big?
I have no idea. Maybe something like the EDSA People Power, something like that, but even then, but it will take, I'm not optimistic that this will happen in the next few years, 10 years. Yeah. But we endure.
Enjoy. Okay.